Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time poor, enthusiasm rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Christopher Such.
Hello again.
And Robert Charples.
Hi.
And in this episode, we're going to discuss English as an additional language and the nuance and hopefully get into a bit of depth. But first, Chris, what are you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
So over the past week, I've had reason to return to some of my favourite papers relating to reading fluency. And one that I've not mentioned on the podcast yet is Kuhn et al.'s 2010 paper, Aligning Theory and Assessment of Reading Fluency. The reason I'm a big fan of this one in particular is it gets into some of the knotty arguments about what the construct actually is, what it can mean, and actually deals with the idea of what makes this construct useful, because there is a tendency in certain areas to basically use the word reading fluency to mean the same thing as just like reading capability. As soon as you insist that a high degree of comprehension must be there for reading fluency, it becomes on some level a less useful construct. And what I liked about this paper is it kind of gets into those issues, unties them, kind of pulls them apart, and tries to leave us with something that is intentionally useful for educators and researchers, which, yeah, I really enjoyed. What about you, Rob? What are you reading for?
So I've just started two new books this week, both of them very work books. I'm reading Jeff McSwan's Multilingual Perspectives on Translanguaging. So translanguaging, we know, is this big set of theories about how the boundaries between languages are not perhaps as solid as we thought they were. And there's different versions of it. Some focus on how languages are stored in the brain and that they might actually be stored without boundaries. So if you know a little French or a little English or a little Urdu or Hindi, in the brain, they're not separate languages, but they're a broader language capacity. And then there's the social side, that we can move between these languages more fluidly in the classroom and in society. And there's been this debate, and I felt recently that the kind of translanguaging side of the argument has really dominated in my reading. So Jeff McSwan's an academic at Arizona State University and has been one of the most prominent critics of that way of thinking. So this is very much against the zeitgeist, but he's talking about multilingualism as in separate languages in the brain. And I'm really enjoying the way it weaves the practical, the cognitive, the social together in this set of arguments. And I really enjoyed that one, except a student has pinched it off me now, so I've got to stop about a third of the way through. And I'm reading Jim Cummins's book on rethinking the education of multilingual students. So I'm sure a lot of people would be familiar with the work of Jim Cummins. He's a Canadian academic. I think he retired quite a few years ago now, but he just keeps accepting speaking invitations because he's so popular. So Jim's work was really, really foundational in helping us to think about bilingualism as something positive and giving us some of the conceptual tools to think about, right, what does it mean to be bilingual in the classroom? And he wrote an earlier book called Bilingual Children Caught in the Crossfire, which gives you an idea of how his work connects to politics and policy. So those two, I think, is two really big thinkers in my field that I've been enjoying. And I'm reading another book just for fun. I cannot remember the title of it. It's got one of those sort of multi-stranded narratives. I can't ever, when I pick it up before I go to sleep, remember where I am in a story, who is speaking at any time, or what on earth it is about. So I'm just desperately trying to finish it, and it's going to sink without a trace in my mind. These two, I think, might stick. So, Kieran, what are you reading for?
They both sound fascinating. I mean, from a purely selfish point of view, I spend a lot of time learning other languages, and I've always wondered if learning another language is adding to what's already there, or, you know, should I learn Italian because Spanish is very, very closely related, that kind of thing. So actually, you know, if it's suitable for the layperson, I might give that a go at some point. I might try and borrow it from your student. Mine is related to last week's episode, Chris. We were exploring early mathematics. Julien Grenier has written a wonderful blog. I think this was published via the Charter College. Rosenshine's Seminal Principles of Instruction, A Dead End or a Must Read for Teachers in Early Years. And it is, as you would expect, a really considered, inquisitive, I think probing at times, but always insightful sort of exploration of quite a contested part of early years pedagogy. And so, you know, I haven't met Julian. I haven't seen him speak, but I imagine to be very softly spoken, very carefully spoken, because it comes across in his writing as if, you know.
I'll ask you a question, both of you. This breaks with the flow of the What You're Reading For section, but I've always wanted to ask you, how do you find the papers that you read? You're both busy people. You don't have, you know, university libraries that remove all the paywalls for all these journals, but you read such consistently interesting and thought-provoking stuff, including a lot of academic papers that most people wouldn't touch. How do you find it? How do you choose it?
Obviously, you know, just search. The obvious thing is Google Scholar, finding anything that happens to be free, reaching out to the authors themselves is a consistently excellent way to get stuff. I'm really surprised how often you can just, there's a paper, who's the lead author? Can I find what university they're at? Can I get an email address? Usually it's a minute, maybe 2 minutes to go through all of that. And then maybe letting away a little trade secret here, I have like a template email for when I send this kind of thing to academics, which basically is all honest. It's, I'm looking to find this paper. I'm really interested in learning more about your work. Would it be possible to get access to X, Y, and Z? So if it isn't on Scholar, then that's where I go. I'm also fortunate enough now that got lots of colleagues who are interested in stuff who quite often will just recommend a paper to me or say, oh, I've already been sent this by the academic who wrote it, and they're perfectly happy to share it. So yeah, the same route as most people, but I do think getting in touch with the authors themselves is a bit of a useful trick.
I have notifications set up for keywords on Google Scholar. So anything from, well, I suppose, I think I started in 2022, comes up every on a weekly email. So a variation theory would be an example. There are many different, I don't know, types of variation theory. There's a mechanical engineering application too, but you sift through it and, you know, you find interesting ones. But I think mostly it's just paying attention to people and who they're reading and who, you know, for instance, I'm quite interested in mathematics and the kind of strategy selection that pupils might go through in their minds. And so there's an American, John Starr, and basically if he has referenced someone in his papers, I'll tend to follow. But a lot of the time, Chris and I will have a discussion, should I say, about a paper, and then we'll go through the sources in that paper, and then things branch off from there.
There's a really big move. So at my institution, we've just been asked to include a Creative Commons license on everything we publish for what's called the author's accepted version. So you submit a paper, and the editor, after some time and some reviews, we'll send back a set of queries and comments that you respond to, and then you submit your final version. Now, somewhere along that process is where it officially leaves your hands and goes into the journal's hands. And some people say that's when the version you first submit before review, some be it's your post-review version before it's typeset. But that's called the author's accepted copy. So the copy that you wrote that's accepted by the journal. And now, as part of the broader commitment to open science, we submit those to a university repository under a Creative Commons license. So you should now be able to get any research that's published, and maybe not the published version, but the very, very, very similar pre-publication version, absolutely free. Sometimes they embargo it. So you say, well, it's, you know, it won't come out for 6 months or 12 months, but I'm delighted if anyone emails me and asks for a copy of something. One of the things people forget is just how little feedback you get when you write for scholarly publications. So it goes off, and you know, some people might read it, and you occasionally, you know, get comments from your colleagues in your close area. That's why conferences are really good, because you actually get to meet some of the people working in your field. But to get an email from someone who said, I've seen this, I'm really interested in reading it, it's fantastic. So you said a trade secret was try getting in touch directly with the authors. Well, a trade secret from the receiving end is, I'd be delighted if someone wrote to me, and just to know that it was useful to people's work would be a real boost. So I would definitely, from the receiving end, encourage people to write out that it's not like your email is going to be read and sort of poo-pooed and think, oh, why would they write to me? Why would someone want to read my work? you know, that person will give a little whoop inside. Oh, someone's reading my work. That's fantastic.
I mean, that is wonderful to hear. I mean, you know, almost hand in hand with this kind of sort of, I don't know, nerdery comes some sort of neuroses. And so you always do imagine, you know, even though it's totally unrealistic, the fact that, you know, oh, you know, this person might be much too important. So it's great to hear that that's not actually the case.
That's great to hear. We might be much too important. It has not been my experience. It's a humbling profession in a lot of ways, because I tend to think of my work as well, I've come to this phrase, putting evidence at the service of practice. But you want to do work that has use, that has value. But at the same time, you're not the one doing that work. So you're always on the margins of things. And sometimes that's a really important position to be in. You do look at things differently, you bring different ideas. But you know, a lot of people will say, basically, the minute you step out of the classroom, you lose touch with reality. And I think if you're someone who's, I mean, yeah, I teach week in, week out, but I teach university students, it's a very different activity. So I think the other side is you're constantly thinking, what contribution does my work make to this thing we're all engaged in? And the system's not perfect. It doesn't work in lots and lots of areas. And I think a lot of people are tied to keeping it going in a lot of ways. And you don't get a lot of distance and space. So there's definitely value in it. But I think from the other side as well, you might look at academics and say, well, they're you know, too busy doing all this research. But I think for a lot of us, it's a sense of having to constantly justify your work in terms of what impact and value it has. So it definitely cuts both ways. And I think conversations like this are really powerful.
Excellent. I mean, with that in mind, would you like Rob to tell us a little bit about yourself and your work related to education?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm an academic. I work at the University of Bristol. And my area, I think in my job title, is language and education. And I like that very much. It captures the two sides of what I'm interested in. So I think most of my work focuses on this thing we call EAL, or English as an additional language. I think we're going to talk about why EAL is a very problematic term and means a lot of things to different people at different times and places. So in my own terms, I might refine that slightly. So I'm really interested in bilingual children, how we can help them learn, how we can help them learn, particularly in schools, although the boundaries of how they learn go beyond the school as well. And family, for example, are really, really important. So is community. But I'm also interested in kids who don't quite fit into how schools work as well. So a lot of my work is with migrant learners, particularly teenage refugees as well. So moving out of the primary space. And what unites all of these is we have an education system that fundamentally wasn't set up for these kids. And if we were trying to design things that would serve them, it wouldn't look very much like it looks now. So we have these tensions built in to education and to everything else that they're engaged in. I'll talk about some of the work we've done, looking at how education connects to other things later. That means it's a constant struggle to rethink how we can get the results, how we can meet their needs, how we can do that in a way that values teachers and teaching and everything else that we're engaged in. And I found it's just been, you know, the most fascinating and challenging and rewarding area to work in. Because you could take the simple view and say, oh, bilingual kids, right? How do we teach them English? Bish, bash, bosh. We must have fixed that by now. But of course, the sheer complexity and diversity of what we call EAL learners. You know, you could have the children of one of my colleagues, both parents, professors. They happen to speak French at home, but these kids are, you know, have very, very high cultural capital, very strong educational backgrounds, and will have absolutely no problem in school. We'll finish primary school and secondary school completely bilingual, high achievers. And then you've got kids who might have spent 2-3 years basically walking here from Afghanistan or Eritrea. And in some of the children I've worked with in my own data collection and research, you know, they describe stories that are absolutely horrifying. You know, trying to cross the Sahara on the back of a pickup truck that doesn't have quite enough fuel to make it, trying to these routes. There's a lot of the boys from Afghanistan talked about certain things that you could later identify with certain forests in Greece, which were well-known staging posts on the migration journey. And they would joke to each other about this kind of 12-country migration. And they're EAL as well. You've got kids in, I don't know, Bradford or where have you, long-standing established bilingual communities, they're EAL. But of course, these children's experiences have nothing to do with each other. So actually trying to get a grip on that complexity is the thing that I think is the challenge, the intellectual challenge that's really rewarding. And it's married up by this practical challenge of trying to see how things could work a bit better. And that balance of the kind of the practical and the academic, I think, is where I spend most of my time. I think I begin to describe myself more now as a very applied researcher, an applied academic. And that's a term I can get my head around now.
You started to talk about some of the complexity of that category and to some extent the problematic nature in perhaps of that label. So perhaps it might be a good time to unpack that a little, because the Department for Education do use the term English as an additional language as a category for particular pupils. Well, what is the nature of this category and the pupils that it seeks to identify?
They kind of do. So what they actually ask to make this EL label is children who are known or believed to speak a language other than English. And already we're into a bit of the grey zone. What does that mean in practice? So for the DfE, a child who is categorised as EAL is a child who has been exposed to another language in early childhood. And that's a really great starting point for beginning to think about it. So you might have a child whose strongest language is English, and you'll very quickly see this, very often see this at the upper end of primary. So children who arrive speaking very, very little English, but who have maybe grown up in England or arrived before the start of school, mum and dad speak another language or languages at home, those children will quickly become English dominant. And by the time they get to the top end of primary, what does it mean that they're EAL? Because yes, the language of the home might be another language, but their most dominant, strongest language is English. So we can see immediately that it doesn't quite fit everything, but it's still a helpful definition. Number one, because it's inclusive. So they're not asking for lots of complex decision making, which requires you to know quite a lot about the background of the student, how they use languages at home. It takes all that away, because that's not something that schools are going to get right every time. In fact, they'll very often not get it right, because how would you possibly know, right? It's not something that will come up necessarily. So it's inclusive. It means it will capture the children it needs to. And it's also because having access to another language at home really makes a difference. So it's a good definition in the sense that it kind of captures everyone. But the problem with it is it doesn't do anything with that. So once you know that a child is EAL, you don't yet know anything that useful. So the next thing you need to know is, are they any good at English? What's their English proficiency? The DfE started collecting that data in 2016 and ended after, I think, 4 terms worth of data collection, 4 long terms, so a year and a bit, in 2018. And this is the official reason is because they collected the data they needed to carry out the analysis they wanted to. That analysis was never published, and I strongly suspect never done. The more likely interpretation is that it got caught up with a bit of a farrago around the collection of country of birth and nationality data and how that data was shared across different government departments, including the Home Office. And they stopped that data collection. And I think that the proficiency data was the baby that went out without bathwater. And it's a huge shame, because good quality proficiency data is the number one, well, proficiency itself is the number one determinant of how well children will do. So not collecting that data means that we are really hamstrung. So, you know, if we were to talk later about things that teachers should know, number one is you've got to get proficiency data for EAL, because with that, you start to know what you want to do. You can base your teaching of decisions on evidence. Without that, you're flying blind. And I think it is absolutely criminal that we don't have that at a national level, especially when it's so tantalizingly close. We started, we could have just kept it going, and we stopped it again. It contrasts with places like Lambeth. So Lambeth have a fantastic head of research, a guy called Fisa Denis, and he's been collecting this proficiency data for decades. So Lambeth Borough Council in London have decades of really good proficiency data, and they can tell you an awful lot about their children and how they learn. Wales has been collecting this proficiency data for a long time. So this is not impossible stuff. But so the DfE definition is EAI is anyone who's exposed to another language, which is inclusive, but doesn't tell you much. The next thing they started collecting but then stopped was the proficiency data, and that's really, really important. But the big problem with this is that EAL is so diverse that actually we need to dig down a little deeper, and schools that have routines for talking about pupils in more detail tend to find this a lot easier.
I was going to ask about misconceptions next, but does it make sense to go a bit deeper into it? I mean, if schools can benefit from sort of a more detailed understanding of the pupils that are in their sort of catchment, their cohorts, is that something that you'd recommend to them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you an example of something that I come across very often, and it's a funny one because I'm always a visitor to people's schools. I get the privilege of being a visitor to an awful lot of schools, and you get to see that real cross section. But 9 times out of 10, I don't have to do the actual work. So I can share things that I think the evidence tells us are likely to be really, really effective. But I think we just need to remember that you can't have academics come in saying, oh, do this, 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 and it'll be fixed. You know, what I would hope to do is support teaching our teacher expertise to make those professional judgments. So some things that I think the evidence tells us are perhaps solid foundations to base those judgments on, if that's a good way of putting it. We know quite a bit about how long it takes children to acquire English. Of course, the averages hide a lot of variation, but it's pretty sound. And we know quite a bit about what happened in primary school. So you could have a sense of, if you know children's starting points and you know reasonably where you might expect them to get to, you've got a broad flight plan. Now, it can't get too detailed because we stopped the data collection. But using, for example, the Lambeth data, Steve Strand at Oxford has done some work with groups of local authorities who happen to have reasonable data. We can tell a fair amount. If I could take a step sideways, I'll give you an example that does come up a lot. A lot of schools that I go into will be able to tell me, especially if they have an EL coordinator, very quickly, these are our pupils. And if I ask, okay, so how would you group these pupils? They'll be able to do that very quickly. So, for example, wouldn't be uncommon for a school to have some of their EL cohort from European countries. And these children would typically have age-appropriate schooling, often strong family support. They would have good levels of literacy in their first language. They wouldn't necessarily speak English. And so when they come to the school, the priority there would be to, right, well, let's make sure they have really rich access to English, lots of opportunities, explicit teaching. And we're confident that in a reasonable amount of time, they'll make that transfer. And there are things you can do to make that more or less effective that we can talk about later. And they might also have a group of children from, let's say, Afghanistan, from East Africa, places like Eritrea or Somalia, who have left underdressed. They've had to flee their countries, for example. They've often had very difficult migration journeys. They may have gaps in their schooling, so that educational history isn't so secure. They may or may not have first language literacy. And of course, we'll often bring a degree of trauma with them. And I will mention, but not dwell on, so I don't end up on a soapbox, that the way our legal system treats these different groups has a real impact on these children's lives. Because the legal system introduces a great deal of insecurity into the lives of some children. And it's very well evidenced that insecurity makes learning really, really hard. And we will remember on recording on a day when we switched home secretaries, we will remember that these are deliberate decisions that have a devastating impact on children's lives. And I think we can't not recognize that political decisions really affect what happens in the classroom for these children. But I won't get too high on my horse there. Okay, so you've got these two groups and an EL coordinator can typically describe them very clearly. But then you ask the next question, which is, okay, so you've got two groups. What's your response in the curriculum, in the support that you offer? And that's where it gets a bit trickier, because very, very often a school will know very, very well who their children are, and they'll know what their EL response is, but there'll be one EL response, and it's usually based on those proficiency scores. So this is what we do for our low proficiency learners. This is what we do for our high proficiency learners. And so knowing about children's proficiency is that great starting point. As you develop it further, I think one of the challenges is to adapt that to the needs of different groups of children. You want to do it in a way that reflects their different needs and introduces that breadth without being overwhelmed by the complexity. And that can be really hard. And I work with a lot of people who really struggle to see past children's trauma, for example. So if you've got children who have experienced a great deal of trauma, it's really hard not just, you just want to give them a hug. You just want to give them a hug and make everything better for them. And you can't always. And for a lot of these children who have had very difficult migration journeys, even at a very early age, they want, their parents want the opportunities that a stretching curriculum gives. And it, just as human beings, that can be a really hard thing to get our heads around. But as you move on from the absolute core, which is knowing what children's English proficiency is and having some strategies or techniques at each stage of proficiency, you start perhaps having a bit of a range in how you respond to different needs. And by that point, you're kind of away from the races, because if you've got two curriculum offerings for two groups of pupils, you're so deep into what they need, how that connects to what you can do, that you've got a really, really strong foundation for all the judgments you need to make from then on. So think about how school could respond. Proficiency, I'll keep saying it, knowing their proficiency and having accurate measurements for that is really important. And then thinking, right, well, look, if this kid has arrived, and, you know, in the secondary level, I've definitely worked with pupils who, you know, never held a pencil and ruler before. How you support those learners is going to be really different for kids who have a really solid educational history, to take two extreme examples. So as you begin to adapt it, then you can put more and more sophisticated systems in place. And we can drill down into detail of what those might be, but it's probably getting a bit specific for now.
I mean, I'm happy to drill down into some of these details. I'm just thinking about the very start of my career, literally the first year that I was in teaching. After a couple of months, a pupil came to my classroom who didn't speak any English, was originally from Slovakia, but he was of a Roma background, mm-hmm. and from the eastern part of Slovakia, and so there was a sense in which even like translation apps weren't, mm-hmm. I mean, this is a bit before translations that were really doing a good job, but also had a very limited experience, in fact, no real experience of formal education. Mm-hmm. And I remember distinctly being told by those who were trying to support me in the classroom with this pupil that I needed to label everything with, you know, Slovak words. And I tried to convince them, say that, well, at the moment, this might not be hugely useful because I know for a fact that this pupil can't actually read Slovak. Yeah. At the moment, so that's I don't see how they still absolutely insisted that it was essential, but even so, I remember at the very core of my, because as a teacher you remember this stuff, I remember the shame of how poorly I felt I was supporting this pupil, because I had no idea what to do. And I remember this sense of, so because it was he arrived quite at the start of the year, I remember some of this sense of shame starting to lift around the six month mark, when it seemed to be the case that he, as well, he'd already made lots of friends, but he was now able to start communicating with them in English, and I was able to communicate with him more to a higher degree. But that 6 months, because he was very, very quiet during that time, I just felt like a failure the whole time. And I'm sure there are lots of teachers in a similar situation. So I'm not asking you to say, oh, okay, here is, you know, the magic solution to any of this stuff. But any advice that I think that might, under certain circumstances, be helpful, I think would be hugely appreciated.
Yeah, well, easy to say, harder to do. Let's start with this idea of shame and guilt, because it, you're so right. You're so right. This is a conversation I have very often, and it goes roughly along these lines. We're not sure what to do with EAL, and the answer isn't a quick fix. So then the answer means there's something that we need to think through again. And that means that there's something I haven't really been thinking about yet. That means there's something I realize that I must have been doing wrong. Oh my God, I've been failing the children. And that takes about 8 seconds. You know, and that sense of that means I've been failing the children or the child. People who choose to spend their lives working with kids are a certain type of people. And I'm going to say as a shorthand, they're basically very, very decent people. And you know, they're not going to brush these feelings off. So let's separate it out a little bit. Let's remember, first of all, that although EAL is very, very far from being a priority at the moment, it wasn't always so. So 2008, 2009, there's a really big workforce development strategy run by the then TDA. They did a big review of the literature. They developed four principles for school workforce development. So it's to include teachers, TAs, school leaders, everyone who works with children. There was a lot of work done in it. And with the change of government in 2010, there was the, remember Michael Gove's Bonfire of the Quangos? Another baby of bathwater. So this project, probably unnoticed, went out when the TDA went out. And so it stopped. But it was a recognition, I mean, a bit over a decade now, but a recognition that this is a multilingual country. You know, one in five children speaks another language at home. This is a multilingual country, and our teaching workforce by and large is not multilingual. And so we need to adapt. We need strategies to do this. It wasn't hugely seen as problematic. The EL population has doubled, I mean, roughly speaking, every 10 years for 30 years. And it currently stands at just over 1.6 million. So we know that its current lack of emphasis is, it's just the current lack of emphasis. It doesn't have to be that way. It won't always be that way. We know that most teachers in training won't get more than about 90 minutes. I do a very good 90 minutes. Lots of my colleagues do 90 minutes. If you have I won't say a hangover, because training, you know, they're graduate students, very responsible people. Let's say a mild cold, you'll miss all your preparation in most teacher training programs for EAL. There's very little high quality professional development. And by high quality, I mean sustained development. So you might be a fan of coaching and mentoring. You might be a fan of instructional coaching. But what I mean is, you're not just getting some twilight sessions or a whole day inset. You're building your capacity and your understanding over time. There's very little of that available. The government has withdrawn. It does sound like I'm really hammering on this government, but I'm afraid they haven't been terrific for the world of EAL. All central government guidance has been withdrawn since 2010. It's been taken out of the Ofsted inspectors' handbooks. It's been taken out of the education inspection framework and its predecessors. And you can see, you know, as each new framework comes out, it's less and less present. There's a line, I think, a line and a half in the teacher standards. And because it's not inspected, and because people aren't trained on it, and because the guidance has been withdrawn, and because we've stepped back from actually committing to preparing people for it in a systematic way, it falls on the individual. And so those feelings of guilt and shame are personal. But in no sane world should anyone be feeling guilty because they don't know how to do something. This is a system level problem. It's an institutional problem, and it's a policy problem, but as always, it falls on the shoulders of individual teachers who are then left feeling dreadful, as you described, because they can't do anything about it. So I know that's not the question you asked, but I wanted to take people through it so that we can see the full context. Number one, that this will come back, you know, everything comes around eventually. But also there are lots of specific ways in which it is not an individual teacher's fault. Now, if you had that pupil and you decided, nah, I can't be bothered, yeah, that's your fault. But if you want to do something and don't know how, that's not on you. So let's talk about what you might do. the absolute first thing, faced with a new child, as you describe, who doesn't speak English, is just a smile. However stressful it is for the teacher, it's infinitely more worrying, stressful for the child. So just being emotionally available, smiling, some people will go for the hug or the little touch on the arm. Some people are as tied up in English as I have. Find any kind of physical contact horrifying, but just, you know, that goes a long way. The next thing I'd say is set up a buddy scheme. So a buddying scheme will go a long way. Now, there's a brilliant scheme run by the Hampshire Local Authority team, Hampshire MTAS it is, and it's called the Young Interpreters Scheme. I'm sure, could we put a link in the show notes? So the Young Interpreter Scheme is absolutely fab because it's super cheap. So I think for a whole year subscription, it's something like £70. And it just covers a bit of their development costs. And you can get caps and badges and pens and all these kind of nice things. And what it does is it trains children to interpret the school, but not the language, which means that you know, if you have a largely monolingual school or a school where not many people speak the language of this particular child, actually, how many children in your ex school do speak Slovak grammar? They're not interpreting the language. They're just showing this new person how things work around here. And actually, a lot of that is a bit of mime of a football. Come over here, you pick up the football, you play a bit of football. You don't have to speak a lot for that. So first of all, is it easy to say, don't feel guilty? That doesn't seem like a fair thing to say. But recognize that there's a particular historical moment where you haven't been prepared. You're going to have to kind of bootstrap this one.
Can I just jump in there a second? It's also worth noting that we have another generation of teachers who arguably might not be that prepared because there's no mention of English as an additional language or any equivalent phrase, bilingual, multilingual, in the core content framework, which seems like a fairly significant oversight. Good people I know who are working in the area of ITT are well aware of that oversight and are... paying that oversight no heed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, this is going to keep going on. So actually, what let's step back a second, because I'm sure a lot of your listeners will be acting as mentors, formally or informally, and supporting new teachers on placement in their IT, whatever form it takes, or once they fully join the profession. You can model that we take this seriously, and I think listeners to this podcast are people who read, who think deeply about these things, and asking newer teachers about the bilingual pupils in their class and modelling that you show an interest, I think, is really powerful. There's this horrible experience. I teach most of my master's programs rather than PGCEs, for example. But there's this horrible moment every time I do talk to our PGC students, which is they come back after they've done another placement and I say, so did you use any of those strategies we talked about? And they basically say, yeah, I was all brushed off by some of the people I talked to in school. Oh, you don't need that. Oh, that's not how we do it. And I think being the change there of actually saying, oh, that's really interesting. You know, just adopt everything your placement teachers bring in. But just showing that you're really interested in what they're doing makes a huge difference. I know the ones who find a kindred spirit or even just an interested leader or mentor or colleague who gives them a bit of encouragement and a bit of rope to pursue it, they come back to the university absolutely buzzing and really, really wanting to develop it. The ones who don't come back deflated. And I think there's so obviously there are many forms of initial teacher education, and I'm more familiar with the university based one, but I'm sure it's the same everywhere. Showing that you're interested and asking about these pupils and saying, how has it been with them? How are they developing and so on? And offering that reassurance is going to be hugely powerful. And I think you're right to mention IT very strongly. So if we were sketching out how we might proceed, recognizing that it's not an individual person's fault, just being welcoming, warm, inclusive, you know, natural human stuff, not worrying too much about the future, like, you know, 9 times out of 10 it will come good in the end. We just need to make sure that it does go that way. A buddying scheme is really, really powerful, because actually most of that early language in the first 6 months, they're going to be learning despite their teachers, not because of it. It is the social interaction with their peers. It's having some buddies. That's where you get all that day-to-day English. We could talk perhaps later about what's involved in acquiring that kind of language. But a very short version is you need lots of exposure to language, lots of opportunities to use it. And it's got to mean something to you. And you get an awful lot of that when you're just playing with your new friends, you know, in the break times and the lunch hour. And so just doing that, you know, you're setting them up to settle into school really well. And kind of taking from that first bit, you might think, well, children who feel secure are going to do all right. Children who know they're valued, know they're loved even, who feel safe, who find the school predictable, who know they can talk to adults and have some friends. Yeah, they're going to be all right by and large. Kids who find their school worrying and unpredictable and can't talk to anyone, who are very isolated, are naturally the children who we need to worry for. So by the time you've got there, before you've actually tackled language at all, you've done a huge amount and you don't need any extra skills to do it. I do recommend that the young interpreter scheme, but you don't have to use it. I just think, you know, there's a really good one that is very, very cheap. It's a no-brainer. But if you want to set up your own, and lots of schools have them, that's great. All you need to do is to make sure that these kids are getting a bit of security. It's a really disruptive time, especially if you've migrated internationally. So after that, what could you do in the classroom? Well, then we come to how we actually learn language. So I think we can think about language learning, language teaching, if you like, explicit language teaching, and we can think about language acquisition. So I'm going to basically summarize and, you know, horribly butcher 40 or 50 years worth of really good research here, but in short, if the children are involved in the life of the classroom, they're going to be exposed to all the language, and so we always would want to recommend against withdrawing them for additional support, except in very limited specific circumstances. As much as possible, if you can include them in the life of the classroom, it's going to be okay. So what would that mean in practice? Well, it might mean, for example, that you sit children who are newly arrived next to high achievers in your class. By and large, and this is for all phases and ages, if you tell a kid they're going to achieve well, they're likely to live up to it. If you tell them that they're going to struggle, they tend to live up to it. So sitting new arrivals with high achievers, it means they get that really high quality model, and that's going to help them a great deal. Include them in your classroom talk. So if you're not yet confident that they will be able to respond to a question, and actually having the language skills and the confidence to do that are separate. So they might actually be able to answer your questions if you're speaking them one-to-one, kneeling next to the table, in a whole class situation to direct a question to them, they might not be able to. So that's a judgment you're obviously very well equipped to make. But you can still include them in the course class by saying, for example, oh, that's something you mentioned earlier when I was coming around, wasn't it, Kieran? Chris, did you talk to your partner about that? You're nodding. Fantastic. I'm really glad that you did. So by keeping them involved in all the talk of the classroom and the activity of the classroom, that's really going to make sure they've got all those raw materials. They need lots and lots of rich language around them, directed to them. They need opportunities to use it, and then it's got to be meaningful. And actually, classroom talk really is meaningful. And by meaningful, you know, there's a reason to ask and a reason to answer. So if we went, my favorite example is to go around a class and say, do you have, so let's try it. Kira, do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have two brothers and a sister.
Oh, Kira. Yes, I have one brother. Repeat.
Yes, I have one brother.
Correct. Chris, do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have two sisters.
Yes, I have one brother.
Yes, I have one brother.
So, you know, I can see their faces and they're not impressed with my teaching skill. There is, you know, we could think of that kind of language practice drilling, and we could extend that to all kinds of worksheets. By and large, every time I mention worksheets, someone looks at me and says, we don't do worksheets in primary. And 2 minutes later, someone else goes, oh, we do actually. You know, there's all kinds of that kind of drilling and practice activity that are often used, and that can take different forms, and a lot of it happens when you're trying to pre-teach vocabulary, sort of repetition of the keywords before they encounter them in the class. But there's no meaning there. There's no reason for you to say those words, yes, I have one brother. You patently don't. So when it's true, when there's a reason for you to ask an answer, and that generally means there's an information gap. So I don't know how many brothers or sisters you have. You do. I would like to know. That's why we're exchanging that information. There is, you know, we might also talk as an aside about facet communication, which is about maintaining relationships. So having asked you about your brothers and sisters, and, you know, you give me looks and say, what is he on about? I might just pause and say, you're all right, mate. Yeah, I'm fine. So we might move that. That might be more about the relationship building side of education. That's really important too. But in a classroom setting, a lot of what we're doing is we're communicating because we want to exchange information. That's really powerful because that's what language is for. So the more we do that in the classroom, the more we include children in the talk of the classroom, the more they're going to benefit. And what's happening under the bonnet, if you like, is their brains are ferocious pattern spotters. All our brains are. So they are piecing together the patterns in language that they're exposed to. And the brain attends to meaning. There's some brilliant research on this that I always misquote. So I shall misquote it to you too. But it's essentially this. If you put someone either in an MRI machine or strap a load of electrodes to their head, and you present them with a sentence, the horse kicked the fence. Absolutely fine. If you present them with a sentence, the horse slept the fence, you've got a meaning error. Why would it? Sleep doesn't fit there. That's not kicked, jumped, sure, but sleep, no. If you present them with the horse kicking the fence, we've got a grammatical error. And the brain responds more quickly to meaning errors. And we are talking like fractions of a second here. You have to have a load of electrodes. It's not hugely applicable to the classroom. The brain responds more quickly to meaning errors than it does to grammatical errors. And we can extend that. There's been quite a lot of research looking at which bits of morphosyntax, so how we build up words and connect them into strings, get retained. So the third person S in English is famously difficult for speakers of other languages to retain. It takes ages and ages to consistently use that, because it's functionally carries no meaning, right? It's useless. She goes, well, we know who it is because the she. So if we say she go or she goes, we know exactly what is meant. So it carries no meaning particularly. And for that reason, it's very, very slow to learn. Those brains, they're looking for patterns, but they are really picking up on meaning. The brain responds to meaning and recognizes those as the most important patterns and is more likely to retain them. So by including that child in the life of the classroom, making sure they're part of all the classroom talk, you're giving them all the raw materials. And you're also giving them the cues to attend to those bits of language. That makes us ask real questions about withdrawal, which might be in a primary setting. You might have the a teaching assistant, for example, work with a small group to prep some vocabulary ready for the class. That, you know, in very broad terms, but generally speaking, that would seem to be effective because you're giving them some preparations so that they can engage more fully in the class. Compare that with having a teaching assistant or other sit with that child through the lesson. Sometimes it's done brilliantly, and that person really helps the child to engage with what's happening in the classroom. But at other times, that child's world shrinks to the person next to them, and they're not getting the full language of the classroom. They're not getting involved in discussion. They don't get what's meaningful and what's not. They don't get opportunities to use their language. And so you can see here how perhaps those kind of broad principles, which I think are very strongly evidence-based principles that we might work with, there are lots of ways to apply them. And this is where I say that, you know, it's not my job to tell people what to do, but there are principles to base your decisions on, which I think lead you to pretty robust decisions, I think, fairly quickly.
And so we're going to pause there. because we have lots more to share next week. I hope you'll agree that that has been a fantastic chat so far, and I'm really looking forward to sharing next week's episode with you. But until next time, thanks for listening.